Hello and welcome to this new edition of Viewpoints. My name is Boris Chassaigne. I'll be with you for the next half hour. On today's show, fiber optics, cable and landlines will soon be available in the small community of Cortes Island.
For the most part in the beginning, we had some issues with weather and a little bit of supply chain issues, but for the most part, it's been going really well. The crews are working very fast and everyone here on Cortes can see that.
Imposing new taxes on non-resident homeowners won't cool down the housing market or make a dent in the housing crisis in Nova Scotia, say local realtors.
My fear is we're upsetting a lot of people who have contributed a lot to the province over the years and kind of slamming the door in their face saying, hey, you're not welcome here anymore.
Municipal employees are giving a thumbs up to the four-day work week. Nova Scotia and New Brunswick follow the trend.
Our sick leave is way down. I find that people are still, they're very excited about it today and they work hard when they're here and they enjoy their time off. So it's really a big win-win for us.
And back in British Columbia, where journalist Pamela Hassan met with the documentarian and filmmaker Kelly Milner, who just produced Not About Me.
She went to a country that she didn't know anything about. She didn't understand the history, the culture, what it is that they actually wanted. So again, really understanding sort of the context of a country when you go to provide aid is really a big piece of what Morgan was trying to do.
Welcome to Viewpoints. Fiber optic cable is slowly making its way to Cortes Islanders through the Connected Coast Project. The project was launched with funding from the federal, provincial, and regional governments to bring high-speed internet to rural and remote communities on the BC coast. The CityWest company was hired to get things rolling, and everything seems to be going according to plan. In January, work began on Cortes Island with crews laying fiber optic cables throughout the community. The CityWest regional manager, Dino Tsakonas, says phase one of the project is nearing completion. The goal is to have service to local homes and businesses by the end of 2022. Greg Osoba met with Dino Tsakonas and tells us the latest.
Sponsored by the British Columbia government, the Connected Coast Project aims to bring fiber optic cable to small and medium-sized communities on Canada's west coast. The goal is to improve communications with reliable high-speed broadband, which includes access to the internet, television channels, and telephone service. Phase one of City West's group's Cortes Island project is nearing completion, and regional manager Dino Tsakonas is satisfied with the progress.
This part of the project has gone great. For the most part in the beginning, we had some issues with weather and a little bit of supply chain issues. And that's got to do with worldly issues, let's say. But for the most part, it's been going really well. The crews are working very fast and everyone here on Cortes can see that.
What have the biggest challenges been?
Supply chain issues, I think, would be the biggest issue. Trying to get all the material to this small island to make this happen. At the same time, getting those materials from wherever we need it in the world. Yeah, because as we know, with communications and any product we're buying in the world today, you need certain pieces from every part in the world. And with COVID, a lot of those products, actually the pieces, were pushed toward that scenario where we were building masks, we're building ventilators, we're doing all these other things. And those products were actually moved off of supplying fiber products, or we're talking plastics, really, in this regard. Yeah.
And then in terms of the timeline and what you were thinking it would take to get this first part of the project on Cortes done, do you feel like you're on time more or less, or how's that sort of the timeline issue going?
Yeah, I think we're very much on time to a certain degree. With any big project like this, there's going to be some, and that's to be expected. But I believe we're definitely within the timelines we're trying to achieve, and for the government and for the people of Cortes, let's say. And we're very fortunate to be on Cortes because we're going to be one of the first communities on the West Coast here to receive these services.
What was basically the goal for this phase of the project? And then what happens after this is completed?
So the goal for this first phase is really to get the internet, the fiber running down all the roads, the roadways, and at the same time, get the fiber from the home to the roadways in preparation for the Connected Coast to come in at some point this year. We're on time for all that stuff. So looks really good. Like, the timelines all are matching up as far as I can see. Whaletown may get a little later than Manson's and Seaford, but we're hoping to light Cortez up, obviously, in 2022.
Okay, so you hope to have the services being provided to homes and businesses by the end of the year?
Correct.
Now, I know that in so many businesses and sectors of work these days, a big challenge has been to find enough labor, enough workers. Have you guys had any of those kinds of issues? Or
yeah, there's definitely a challenge that way all the time in any community you're in, whether it's the training that's needed for that particular person or in that community to help with that particular project, or whether it's getting the people to come to that island to work. I mean, Cortez, we're a remote community. Let's put it that way. It's not easy to get workers out here. And also there's housing issues. And yeah, there's so many different factors that play into that question. These are concerns that we have here on these remote islands. We're doing the best we can to try to hire a local because that makes most sense. But also you still need to have the ability for that local contractor or person to have the ability to actually do that work. There's the skills and the equipment if they need it.
Now, let's get back to the actual City West project here and bringing fiber optic cable. What sort of services will you be providing once it's up and running, hopefully by the end of the year?
We're going to be providing internet, telephone, and TV services.
I was wondering, when you say phone, that's the one thing I'm curious about. How does that work? Because, for example, I need a landline because we have pretty limited cell service on Cortez, so I can't rely on that in my home. And when you offer phone, how would that basically, could that take the place of a landline?
Correct. Yes. So it acts just like a landline. And if you do sign up for phone service, you will actually have a little battery pack installed inside your modem that will last for up to 12 hours, dependent on use, when there's power outages. And City West will too do everything they can to power when it comes to shore, because that's when we need power for the fiber project to keep that fiber going so it can communicate and the phones will continue to run.
Okay, that's what I was wondering about. As we do get frequent power outages, especially in the winter on Cortez, but then because of the fiber optic stuff itself, I'm assuming the internet itself doesn't need the same kind of battery backup, is that correct, as a phone service would?
Yes, it does. It does. I live on Cortez too, and I've been here for almost 20 years, and I'm very familiar with this scenario. And like I said, I'll be very heavily involved with this, I would imagine, with making sure that these battery backups happen, because I'm going to have a phone line. So are my parents and everyone else, all my friends here. And it's a very essential service. We need to be able to call 911 when we can. That is something that's very essential out here, and we're going to make that happen.
So it sounds like at least when the power does go out, there will be a continuation of service for a minimum of 12 hours.
Minimum of 12 hours and dependent after that. But I would like to try for 48. That's without any type of intervention.
Tsakonas adds that City West also hopes to bring fiber optic cable to homes and businesses on Hornby Island and is contracted to provide service to several small Vancouver Island communities. Greg Osoba, Cortez Island.
Hey, I'm Anastasia Avakumova in beautiful British Columbia, and you are tuned to Viewpoints.
The Canadian federal and provincial governments are trying to cool down the housing market by imposing new taxes and measures targeting non-resident homeowners. Measures announced in Nova Scotia's latest provincial budget will impose a 5% deed transfer tax on the sale price of a home and a provincial tax of $2 per $100 of a home's assessed value for anyone from outside the province purchasing a house in Nova Scotia. The new tax measures, which went into effect on April 1st in Nova Scotia, could generate $81 million in revenue by the end of 2022-2023. According to the Nova Scotia Finance Department, there are about 27,000 properties in Nova Scotia that are owned by non-residents, more than half of whom come from Ontario, according to Keith Doucette from the Canadian Press. And in Ottawa, the Canadian government announced in its latest budget that it plans to table legislation that would implement Canada's first national vacant housing tax on non-Canadian non-resident owners, also trying to cool down prices. But a Nova Scotia realtor says the non-resident tax will alienate the community and not solve the housing crunch. More with our Liverpool reporter, Ed Alverson.
New taxes targeting non-resident homeowners won't address the affordable housing issue, according to a local realtor. Measures announced at the provincial budget will impose a 5% deed transfer tax on the sale price of a home and a provincial tax of $2 per $100 of a home's assessed value for anyone from outside the province purchasing a house in Nova Scotia. Christopher Snarby, managing associate broker with Exit Interlake Realty, says everyone knows a lack of available housing has caused prices in the purchase and rental markets to soar, but taxing buyers from outside the province won't solve the issue.
These new rules are only applying to people who don't live here full time. And for example, for me in the past year, I've dealt with a lot of Ontario buyers and Western Canadian buyers, but they're all moving here full time. So nothing's going to change on that front.
Another issue Snarby sees is the homes that would be subject to the tax aren't generally in the price range for first-time home buyers.
It's not the bread and butter. It's not the $100,000 homes or the $200,000 homes. Probably a lot of them are oceanfront, you know, lakefront, really high-end homes that are in the $500,000 to $1 million range, and in Halifax even more maybe. So that's the other part of the puzzle, is that it's not really the houses that the general public can afford.
Snarby says many of the non-resident homeowners have come to the area year after year, supporting local businesses and services, and have become part of the fabric of the community.
My fear is we're upsetting a lot of people who have contributed a lot to the province over the years and kind of slamming the door in their face saying, hey, you're not welcome here anymore.
Finance Minister Alan McMaster says taxing non-residents will make more housing available in Nova Scotia because it attacks the problem on a couple of fronts. First, the tax will raise money that government can put into affordable housing. And second, it should cool demand for houses from buyers outside the province.
It's an inexact science. I will not come on and make claims that this will solve everything, these taxes will solve everything. But we do believe that they will have some impact. And over the next 2 years, we'll be building a database. We'll know just how much we'll be raising in terms of revenue, and we'll know just how much of an impact these taxes will have on the housing market and whether or not they do in fact increase supply for Nova Scotians.
Despite announcing the taxes to tackle the housing crisis, McMaster says money collected won't be set aside. Instead, it will go into the provincial government's general revenue.
We haven't collected a cent of these taxes to date, but we've already spent money last fall. We earmarked $35 million for affordable housing. We added another $15 million in the budget that was introduced a week or so ago. We're taking in money, and there's money going out the door all the time. And practically speaking, sometimes it's difficult to just say, okay, we're going to use these funds for a certain purpose.
McMaster says government will continue to look for ways to help Nova Scotians into homes, but is definite on one thing.
We need more housing, whether it's government purchased and managed housing, whether it's cooperative housing or whether it's private sector.
McMaster acknowledges building up the housing stock will take time, and in the interim, government will make more rent supplements available to get people into rental units that may be outside their budget. The new tax measures went into effect April 1st. I'm Ed Halverson.
Follow us on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.
Workers for the town of Sackville, New Brunswick, will be trying something a little different this summer, working a compressed week of just 4 days, but with longer hours for each of them. The new pilot program will run for 3 months this summer and will be reevaluated as a longer option for the town's workforce. Sackville was inspired by the small community of Guysborough in Nova Scotia, which was one of the first in Canada to try the compressed work week. Barry Carroll is the chief administrative officer of Guysborough, off on the southern tip of Nova Scotia. He's with our Sackville journalist, Erica Butler.
It evolved out of COVID, really, because we probably wouldn't be at it today only for COVID. So kind of a good news story coming out of COVID for us.
At the outset of the pandemic, Guysborough had split their workforce of about 60 into two teams and alternated days on site with working from home. The flexibility was popular, as was the ability to keep in operations during COVID.
And the idea just came up, and one day, honestly, I was listening to, we were listening to the Premier, Prime Minister doing one of his briefings, and he mentioned the four-day work week as well, and we said, look, maybe this is something that we can try on a pilot basis. So I think it was in mid-June of 2020, we instituted a nine-month pilot for a compressed work week. Subsequent to that, I think it was in March 2021, Council signed off that we would implement it full-time. So that's kind of how we got going.
The Guysborough system kept the two-team system they had established at the outset of the pandemic, but this time working compressed work weeks of 4 days, one from Monday to Thursday and the other from Tuesday to Friday.
You know, it is a compressed work week, so everybody is working the same number of hours. If you work a 35-hour work week, now you're actually probably working closer to 36 in the way that the days break out. But we do include, half an hour for lunch for people on site within that period of time. So if you're working a 40-hour work week, you work four 10-hour days, essentially.
Carol says the compressed work week has been successful in Guysborough, with people noticeably happier.
Honestly, there's a bounce in people's step every day of the week. They're as excited about it as, you know, when we first implemented it 2 years ago, they were excited, and they're just as excited today. Our sick leave is way down, and, our days are way down on the stats. I forget the percentage, but it's more than 50% that it's down. And people, you know, they have time to, you know, book a dentist appointment on the day they're off, or take the car to the garage, or do whatever they need to do. And of course, for our younger employees, that have daycares and, you know, to think about and all that sort of stuff, is a bit of a break for them to get to spend more time with their families. And yeah, so it's been a win-win. So in the workplace, I find that people are still, they're very excited about it today, and they work hard when they're here, and they enjoyed their time off. So it's really a big win-win for us.
Putting a bounce in people's step is exactly what Jamie Burke is hoping to accomplish in Sackville. Burke says the idea for the compressed week actually started with some town workers who had heard of what was happening in Guysborough.
A couple of employees had had come to me and wanted to make sure I was aware of that program. And then secondly, I guess, particularly after, say, the Christmas break, it became apparent to me that morale within the workforce was down a little bit. And, you know, I don't know if that's a combination of the winter blues, kind of the post-Christmas anxiety. Certainly the pandemic has had a lot to do with it, I'm sure. But, we're also going through a restructuring, so I know that's on employees' minds as well. So I think it's a combination of things that makes you kind of realize that you need to do something. You need to do something to show employees and invest in employees that they're important, and that, you as the leader of the organization and appreciates the work that they do. So that's really what inspired the initiative.
The compressed work week was one of three initiatives to make for a happier town workforce. Council recently approved a new benefit that gives town workers up to $300 back each year on wellness-related expenses like gym memberships, yoga classes, or personal fitness equipment. The third new policy allows for employees to bring their dogs to work.
It's working out very well, and if nothing else, it's made the workplace a little more fun.
Much of the chatter about the four-day work week in the media and online has to do with actually reducing hours of work. But the Guysborough and now Sackville versions of the concept keep classic work hours. Inside workers will stick with their 35-hour work week and work slightly longer days. That will in turn allow Town Hall to be open an hour longer each day for public service, a benefit that Guysborough also experienced. When it comes to outdoor workers, there's a 40-hour work week that needs to be crammed into 4 days.
We will talk to employees as we go through this, and we'll talk to employees at the end of this to determine whether or not it's we can do it again, or it can be expanded, enhanced, tweaked, etc.
Burke says he and the management team consulted with staff before going ahead with the pilot, and that included consulting the workers' union. The final clincher for staff acceptance of the compressed work week pilot, it's not mandatory.
So there's really no pressure on employees to participate. But certainly, if you look at the success of the Guysborough project, you know, almost their entire workforce has opted in, which is my understanding wasn't the case originally. So in our situation, we have a handful of employees who have indicated they would prefer to opt out, even at least initially, and that's okay. We're fully supportive of that, given the way the schedule has been designed. We're very confident that there shouldn't be any hiccups over the summer.
It's not clear what will happen in September as the pilot winds down. Burke is less confident that such a program can work through snow clearing season, but he's open to possibilities. As it stands now, on September 3rd, staff will return to their current five-day-a-week schedule. But for the summer months at least, those who opted in will enjoy alternating four-day weekends, all without taking a single day off. Like his counterpart in Guysborough, Burke sees a win-win.
So increased accessibility, no additional cost to the employer, and additional time off for the employee to spend with family and friends. So that's ultimately what we were trying to achieve, and thankfully the way the schedule has worked, we've been able to do that.
Hi, I'm Pamela Hassan in Smithers, BC, and you are listening to Viewpoints.
When Morgan Weinberg, a well-meaning Canadian teenager, volunteers at a Haitian orphanage in the aftermath of the 2010 earthquake, her plans take a turn. She is part of an army of NGOs and volunteers with billions in promised aid, all rushing to respond to the disaster. But once on the ground, she begins to see their earnest actions have their own devastating impacts. Determined to make a more lasting difference, Morgan Weinberg stays in Haiti to find a better way to help children and their families. Over the next decade, Morgan challenges her own perceptions and privilege to become a more meaningful partner to Haitians working to build a better future. That's when Kelly Milner, the Yukon filmmaker out of Whitehorse, decided to produce a documentary to tell Weinberg's story. She's the director and producer of What About Me, which was premiered in Smithers, BC last April. Not About Me is a feature documentary showing that good intentions can produce unintended consequences. RBC journalist Pamela Hassan speaks with documentarian and filmmaker Kelly Milner about the making of the film and the real takeaway from the story.
I'm from Whitehorse. There's this woman who's sort of very well known in Whitehorse, Morgan Weinberg. She was somebody who went to Haiti after the earthquake in 2010 and, you know, has started an organization, and everyone in Whitehorse seemed to know Morgan. She was, you know, sort of a local hero. About 5 years ago, her mom approached me with, she had a hard drive full of footage that other filmmakers had taken over the years of Morgan and her work down in Haiti, and asked if I'd be interested in maybe doing a story about it. And I realized, you know, at that time, I really didn't know much about Morgan. I knew that she, you know, did something good in Haiti with kids. And I think, like a lot of people, I just assumed it was an orphanage. And it wasn't until I started making this film and really challenging my assumptions of what it means to provide aid and really being challenged by Morgan herself. That was sort of when I finally talked to Morgan about this project. She said, you know, I'm happy for you to use this footage, but I just want this story to not be about me. And so it really was this idea of how do you tell a story about something that I think a lot of people thought they knew what Morgan's story was, because I think it was something they wanted for themselves too. But I think it's really been an interesting journey to tell a story of somebody who had really good intentions, but realized that they had unintended consequences. And what can we learn from that?
The website for the film, which is notaboutme.com, it not only hosts the trailer and film bio, but it also has a deeper look to understand how Haiti has arrived where it is today, how colonialism, racism, and foreign interventions are at the root of so many Haiti's problems. And that's quoting the website. So do you feel that your approach to this film achieves what you set out to do? Because from the trailer, it's obvious that becoming the great white savior was not Morgan's intentions, but however, it was a bit of an easy trap. What is your film saying that other documentaries about countries that suffer disease crises and natural disasters, as well as corruption, are missing?
Well, I think it's, you know, for Morgan, I think initially she was going there maybe as the great white savior. I think that's what's so interesting about Morgan is that she is very humble and willing to talk about the mistakes that she made. The idea of sharing her story was because she wants people to learn from her mistakes so that they don't have to do them themselves. I think really, you know, from her perspective, it was realizing that, you know, she went to a country that she didn't know anything about. She didn't understand the history, the culture, what it is that they actually wanted in terms of assistance, but also understanding the history of colonialism and, you know, the fact that Haiti has been a free country. They beat Napoleon. They were the second republic in the Western world, and it was a free Black republic. So again, really understanding sort of the context of a country when you go to provide aid is really a big piece of what Morgan was trying to do by sharing her story. And I think, again, it was a challenge for us as filmmakers to really take a look at some of that and understand how that was even shaping our approach to telling this story. And is it perfect? I don't know. I feel like I was on the same journey, probably when I started making the film, what I knew and understood compared to what I knew and understood by the end of 5 years of working at this is really quite a different place. So I'm really grateful of that journey that I went on. And I hope that that's partially what people will get when they watch the film.
Mm-hmm. When you watch it again, I mean, are you seeing, do you feel like there's voice and, you know, like enough voice given to Haitians speaking about their country and also, and instead of people speaking about Haitians, but do you feel like there's enough representation of Haitians speaking openly, honestly, and about their situation rather than someone else speaking for them?
Yeah, and that was a really important piece of what when we went. So I had when I talked about the footage that I'd received, it was footage that had been filmed sort of between 2010 and I think it was like 2015, 2016. And so when I looked at it, you know, that was, it didn't have an ending and it really didn't have some of those contextual pieces. And so when we went to Haiti for our own filming, that was a big focus, was to interview and give voice to the Haitians that are working with Morgan and who Morgan collaborates with. So speaking to, you know, the head of social services in Haiti, who's in charge of orphanages and regulating orphanages in Haiti, speaking to the head of the police for the Child Protection Brigade in Haiti, hearing from the orphanage survivors themselves, you know, the young Haitians who've lived through years of being part of the orphanage system in Haiti. Those are really important voices that we wanted to make sure were shared. But at the same time, this is a story that Morgan actually is a really important piece of it. And I think she's very relatable. I think she's a character that many Westerners and, you know, quite frankly, white people can relate to. Many of us have been Morgan or want to be Morgan. And so I think really understanding who the audience is that we're trying to reach, I think Morgan's voice in this is, and seeing Morgan and her transformation is actually a really important piece of it as well.
Thank you so much for speaking with me today.
And this ends this edition of Viewpoints, produced by the Local Journalism Initiative and presented by the Community Radio Fund of Canada in collaboration with campus and community radios across the country. Thanks to our journalists Pamela Hassan, Craig Osoba, Ed Halverson, Erica Butler, and their guest, and to Maureen McEwen, our national coordinator, and to the artists who help us out with their music. You can listen to all of our programs on canada-info.ca, canada-info.ca. Also tune in to all the stories produced by dozens of journalists working across the country in British Columbia, Ontario, Quebec, Nova Scotia, New Brunswick, and elsewhere on canada-info.ca. Their radio pieces are posted there on a daily basis. They allow us to discover Canada and our local communities from a different perspective. I'm Boris Chassaigne. Stay tuned to your local radio station. Thanks for being with us. Goodbye.
on Twitter at CanadaLJI. Listen to all our news online at canada-info.ca.